This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Hedge School with editor Tommy Graham in the chair. On the 9th of September 1921, over 50 IRA prisoners staged a breakout, one of several during the War of Independence, from the Rath internment camp in the Curragh, County Kildare. To mark its centenary and to discuss the wider significance of prisons and prisoners in the revolutionary period, I'm joined by James Durney, author of Interned, The Curragh Internment Camps in the War of Independence, published by Mercia Press in 2019. Mary McAuliffe, a regular Hedge School panellist, assistant professor in gender studies at UCD, and author of the forthcoming Kilkenny, The Irish Revolution, 1912 to 1923, published by Four Courts Press. William Murphy, Associate Professor in the School of History and Geography in DCU St. Patrick's Campus, Drumcondra. Liam O'Dwyer, author of Prisoners of War, Ballykinler, An Irish Internment Camp, 1920 to 1921, published by Mercia Press in 2012. And this Hedge School is supported by Kildare County Council, County Kildare Decade of Commemorations Committee, and the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Now, William Murphy, could I start with you? William, could you clarify the legal framework under which people were imprisoned, interned, or whatever term you want to use? Because there's different pieces of legislation, the Defence of the Realm Act, the Restoration of Order Act. Could you clarify that for us, please, William?
Sure. So, those who were held or imprisoned in Ireland during the revolutionary period across the whole phase were, you know, imprisoned using a series of different means by the authorities. And there were prisoners who were, you know, convicted in civil prisons under ordinary civil law. And there were prisoners who were convicted by court martial under emergency legislation. But I suppose the group we're really thinking about today are those who were interned without trial. And depending on the phase of the conflict, they might constitute a very large proportion or a very small proportion of those who are being held. The key piece of legislation initially was the Defence of the Realm Act. And that was introduced in the early days of the First World War by the British authorities in response to the outbreak of the war. And it was a short piece of legislation, but it had wide-ranging ramifications. And it was essentially followed by the introduction of a whole series of regulations known as Defence of the Realm regulations, which gave the military authorities pretty wide-ranging powers to secure public safety and the defence of the realm, as they put it. And the key regulation that was used against Irish revolutionaries was Regulation 14B. And that was a regulation which had initially been written to provide for the internment of what were known as alien internees. So in other words, Germans or Austrians who were living in Ireland at the time of the war, and who it was feared might be a fifth column.
William, just stop you there, William. How many people were interned? How many Germans or Austrians or Hungarians were interned in Ireland? Just as a matter of interest.
In Ireland, there was several hundred, and they were held in various periods in Tipperary and also at a converted workhouse in County Meath in Oldcastle. Across the UK, in total, there were, I think, about 50,000, if I remember correctly, and there was an enormous internment camp in
quite a substantial number of people.
Yeah, huge numbers of people.
Anyway, I sorry for that digression, but that's an interesting way. I think we had an article on that years ago in History Ireland on that that camp in Tipperary. Anyway, William, sorry for interrupting you.
Yeah, no, not at all. So it was the same regulation that was used then to intern Irish revolutionaries. The first time there was mass internment was used, so that's after the 1916 rising, and it was Regulation 14B. And the Irish could be held on that occasion because they were deemed to have a hostile association. So in other words, they had regarded as cooperating with the Germans to launch the rebellion at that stage. And over 3,000 people were arrested under the Defence of the Realm Act at that period. And about 1,800 ended up in Frongoch internment camp, which is the most, I suppose, well-known site of internment after the 1916 rising in the early summer of 1916. And that number declined across the rest of the year, and eventually they were all released in late 1916. There were some other cohorts held in Reading Jail, a sort of leadership group, and I'm sure Mary would want me to emphasise that there were a small number of women who were also interned in Lewis Prison at that time. And the Defence of the Realm Act was deployed again by the authorities to intern Irish revolutionaries or Irish, you know, rebel activists on a couple of occasions. It was used in May 1918 in what is known as the German plot. And on that occasion, initially 69 leading Sinn Féin activists, I suppose either well-known national figures or people who were on the national executive or some of them well-known local leaders, were arrested. And really that's a response to the conscription crisis and the rise of Sinn Féin in Ireland, and it's the government's response to that. And eventually there will be 92 prisoners held at that stage across various prisons in England, and they're interned without trial, and they're held under not an ordinary prison regime, but an ameliorated regime which is considered appropriate to people who haven't been convicted. The Home Office was not at all happy about having to hold these people. They would have preferred if they were held in a camp, but actually they were held in prisons. And we might return to them again later, maybe when we're discussing, you know, escapes and things like that. And then the next time internment is used is in very late 1919, November 1919. The government again decides, in response to increasing trouble in Ireland, that we'll use the Defence of the Realm Act once more to intern some leading Sinn Féin activists. Only four in December, but they escalate that in January 1920, in the days and weeks after the attempt to assassinate Sir John French, the Lord Lieutenant. And the numbers climb so that by early May, there are well over 200 interned in England, again in prison, largely in Wormwood Scrubs, although some of them in Brixton. And that phase ends as a consequence of a mass hunger strike at Wormwood Scrubs in late April and early May 1920, and the prisoners are released. And then I suppose we get to the phase that we are talking about today that relates to the escape out of the Curragh. And you get mass internment again after Bloody Sunday as a consequence of the escalation of violence in late 1920 in Ireland. And in that phase, there are two pieces, I suppose there are two ways in which internment happens. People are interned under the Restoration of Order in Ireland Act, which was passed in August of 1920. And that act was again a piece of emergency legislation, and it enshrined in law a lot of the wartime emergency provisions. And it kept them in law in Ireland, even though they were falling away in the rest of the country, because obviously the war was over, World War was over. Again, it was Regulation 14B that was used there under that act to intern. And then in martial law areas, in actual fact, the military could just intern without trial under martial law suspects in this period. So very quickly, the figures accumulate, and you have over 4,500 arrests between November of 1920 and July 1921 under either martial law or under the Restoration of Order of Ireland Act, and in internments. Some of those are released. So, for instance, we get to the truce. There's 3,300 men were in camps. Ballykinlar, the Curragh, Spike Island, Bear Island, across Ireland. They're being held, interned without trial.
Okay, thanks for that, William. Now, that set a good framework for us. James, can I bring you in here just on the post-1916 situation? Just in terms of those they interned, did they intern the right people? Because it's often said that, you know, that people who had no connections at all were rounded up, and that in fact it did more damage to the British cause than good.
Yeah, that's true, because of the 3,000 plus arrested, 1,424 were deemed to be innocent and were released within 2 weeks of being arrested. The rest, as William said, were held under DORA 14B, which was interment without trial and transferred to prisons in Britain. But because of the increase in political pressure, some of the less militant prisoners were released, so that by the end of July 1916, 600 men remained, mostly at Frongoch. But when they start to release them then again in towards the end of 1916. These were under categories of A, B, and C, and it was the prisoners designated Class A, or were internees who, in the opinion of the police, should not be released. And these were the ones that were held until the end. The prisoners designated Class C meant that they were not of much importance and either took part in the rebellion or had come under notice prior to it. And prisoners of this category were able to obtain release and given a signed undertaking to be of good behaviour and the payment of a bond, usually £50 or £100, and letters of recommendation from noted people, probably local politicians and that even. So the Class A prisoners then were still held, and the likes of, I came across Frank Burke's file, and he was only recommended his release and the payment of two approved sureties, one in the amount of £50 from himself and another bond of £100 from his father. And a report noted that his father had 200 acres and will be able to pay this amount.
So did quite a number of people pay up then, James? Is that what you're saying?
Well, it seems to be, yeah.
And did many of them forfeit their money subsequently? I'm just curious, right? Because many of them went on to have active careers, you know, one way
or
another.
Yeah, I don't think they would have got their money back.
Right, okay. So they thought it was a good investment to get themselves out.
Yeah.
Tell me this, James, how many prisoners were elected in 1918, do you happen to know?
Well, when the Dáil Éireann convenes in January 1919, there's only 28 or 27. It's always a debate which figure of TDs actually turned up. So the rest of them were, over half of them were prisoners who were elected to the first Dáil. And many of them, of course, didn't attend because they were in prison. And when their names were called out, it was met with a reply, "Fead lass a golf," which meant locked up by the foreigners.
Okay, and I suppose even if you're locked up only for 2 weeks in the original roundup, it would do your subsequent political career no harm at all. The fact that you were rounded up, I suspect.
But see, Mary, the movement knew this, that they would get more sympathy with men in jail when we're putting candidates forward.
Tell me this, James, in some ways, does this set the template for what happens later? Because post-1916, you got internment camps, prisoner candidates, and of course, you've hunger strikes. Maybe I'll move on to you, Mary, on that one, right, to Thomas Ashe's hunger strike, because this is something we associate with republicanism generally. But in fact, Ashe's hunger strike was an innovation at that time. The suffragettes were the ones who pioneered that particular tactic, weren't they?
There were. And then William deals with that in the first chapter in his book on prisoners and political imprisonment. And the suffragettes actually did innovate, I suppose, the hunger strike, the political hunger strike, when they were arrested and being put in jail and then being released under the Cat and Mouse Act. And in doing my research, say, on Margaret Skinner, for example, I was looking at the Scottish suffragettes in Glasgow, and how mistreated they were and how they were being force-fed in English jails, because you don't have a lot of it in Ireland. Hanif Shee Skeffington, for example, goes on hunger strike for a few weeks, but she's never force-fed. I think they don't want to create martyrs in an Ireland that was already, having some tension around politics in that time. But in Perth Prison, for example, some of the women were being fed through their vagina, for example, or through the nose or through the mouth, and they were being mistreated horribly. And this is where Margaret Skinner, who later goes on to be an Irish revolutionary, becomes radicalised and politicised. So you can see that the hunger strike among the suffragettes does lead to a significant radicalisation of political women, not just in Ireland, but throughout the UK and indeed in America and various other parts of the world where the suffragette movement was beginning. But going back to what William and James were talking about there, the prisoner release, of course, one of the most famous prisoners released in 1917 was Countess Markievicz, and the enormous turnout for her welcome home was extraordinary. Thomas Ashe was released as well, and then under license, obviously, and because of his activities, was rearrested and imprisoned in Mountjoy in later 1917, goes on hunger strike, then is force-fed. Obviously, it all goes terribly wrong. he then dies, and his funeral creates an extraordinary political response as well. So the activities of the authorities using the Dora regulations, imprisonment without trial, hunger striking, force feeding, served to continue the politicization of the Irish population post-1916, as does the activities of women. Because, of course, with all these leaders of the Republican movement in jail post-1916 until their release on into 1917, it is the women who are leading a lot of the fundraising, who are leading a lot of the rebuilding of the Republican movement, reorganization of the Irish Volunteers, of all the organizations that had participated in 1916, setting up the organizations like the Irish National Aid and Volunteers Dependent Fund. Kathleen Clark is very much involved in that, even though she herself has been widowed in 1916, also lost her brother who was executed, and has a miscarriage because of the trauma of what had happened to her. So you see these women beginning to become very much more radicalized. They were already fairly radicalized pre-1916. But once the main prisoner, the Category A prisoners are released, among them De Valera, McNeil, Cahill-Brua, Plunkett, and all of those, you begin to see the women are beginning to feel they are being sidelined, that they will not be part of the political leadership going forward. And they're determined that this doesn't happen. For example, in April 1917, there is a meeting of the called by Count Plunkett, the so-called Council of Nine. And there was only one woman on that, Countess Plunkett, the wife of the Count, who wouldn't be a radical suffragette and was quite elderly at the task at the time. And the women were very the political women were very dubious that she would be up to the task. So the women set up what we now call the League of Women Delegates, in order to campaign to have full equality on the leadership, on the executive of Sinn Féin, and that they would be part of any political decisions going forward. So while the release of the prisoners on into 1917 is adding to the fervile atmosphere that is in Ireland at the time, the women are very, very anxious that their participation in politics will continue. And so they campaign for that. They don't see themselves as in a supporting role. They see themselves as comrades in this fight going forward.
Okay, William, can I get back to you just on the German plot? Am I right in assuming that it was a bit more surgical in who were arrested? Who exactly were interned at that time?
So you have the Sinn Féin, I suppose, TDs at that point, or... they're not yet TDs, they're MPs at that point. De Valera is interned. Arthur Griffith is at that side running for by-election in East Cavan, and he's interned. Carefully selected members of the effective nationalist executive of Sinn Féin are interned at that point. But also you get local leaders around the country in turn. So as I say, it's 69 are picked up and arrested in the first instance. Like people like Desmond Fitzgerald, who is a well-known campaigner at this point for Sinn Féin, and he's arrested while in Cavan campaigning for Arthur Griffith.
Now, 69 is quite a lot when it comes to leadership people, right? So did this effectively decapitate the Sinn Féin movement, or did it make any difference at all in terms of their momentum?
It has an effect. It certainly does have an effect. There is a removal of a significant cohort within the leadership. But one of the effects in actual fact is that it sees the removal of those who are perhaps more prominent in the public sphere, those among the leadership who one might identify as being more politician and less military man, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. So some of those who are left behind uninterned are people like Michael Collins, Harry Boland, etc. And Collins and Boland then become increasingly prominent in the leadership of Sinn Féin and have more control over the leadership of Sinn Féin in late 1918 and early 1919. And one of the arguments that's often made is that leads to the radicalization of Sinn Féin in this period. For instance, it allows Collins and Boland to have greater control over the selection of candidates at the 1918 general election. the British themselves, or at least a conciliatory group inside the British leadership, suspects this in late 19 and into early 19, late 1918 and into early 1919. And it's one of the arguments they begin to make in the early months of 1919, when they begin to say it's time to release the Sinn Féin leadership. They say, look, the war is over. It's very difficult to justify legally holding these men and women anymore because they're being held under wartime emergency legislation. They're concerned about the fact that prisoners are becoming more agitated and they're beginning to protest. And indeed, there are escapes beginning to happen. They're concerned by influenza because some of the prisoners are becoming very ill. And two of them die, in fact, and that has propaganda advantages for the revolutionaries. But also, crucially, they argue that if you release people like Griffith and De Valera, you'll be able to talk to them. You might be able to negotiate a future Ireland with them, whereas it's going to be much more difficult to interact with the more radical men who are currently on the loose and in control of the movement in early 1919.
Now, William, this of course gave rise to the first big spectacular escapes, De Valera's. Now, I'm sure many of our listeners have seen the Neil Jordan's Michael Collins. I mean, was Deb's escape as hilarious as depicted in that film?
It is a quite extraordinary event. It was the second escape among the German plot prisoners in the early weeks of 1919. Four men had escaped out of Usk on the 23rd of January, Joe McGrath, George Geraghty, Frank Scholes and Barney Mellows. And that had caused quite a stir. There was lots of press coverage. Mockingly, some of their fellow prisoners had suggested that perhaps the four had gone to the peace conference in Paris, and that's the reason they had exited Usk. But there was even a greater stir when, on the 3rd of February, De Valera, Sean Milroy and Sean McGarry made their way out of Lincoln Prison. And indeed, like, De Valera obviously was an extremely prominent figure, but McGarry was also president of the IRB at this point. And most people probably know this. It was a very convoluted escape. Initially, De Valera managed to make impressions of a key that the chaplain had left lying around. And that impression had been turned into a sketch. And then the sketch had been sent out and a key had been made and it had been sent in a cake, smuggled in a cake. And the first key didn't fit. So then they had to try again and send in a second cake. And that didn't work either. So then they sent in blanks and files so that one of the prisoners, a man named Delocry, made keys inside the prison. And eventually, after all these sort of adventures and misadventures, they made it out with the assistance on the outside of Collins and Boland, who arrived off from Ireland, and also people like Paddy O'Donoghue of the Irish Volunteers in Manchester, who assisted the escape outside. And they smuggled them away from Manchester and back home to Ireland. And it caused a huge, huge stir in the Irish and British press. And it sort of raise questions about the competence of the authorities, indeed, that, they couldn't, having interned these men, they couldn't hold them.
But did De Valera dress up as a woman in disguise?
I think some license is taken with there. I mean, there are multiple versions of the escape story, but I think the sort of dressing up as a woman is probably an exaggeration. Again, it depends on the account you read.
It's an irresistible image, though, isn't it? Eamon De Valera in drag. Okay, let's move on from that. Liam, I just want to bring you in now. So what was the situation then by early 1920? Because the difficulty with the British is the war is now over, so the usual justification for extraordinary legal powers no longer exists. So what was the situation? And you had, of course, the attempted assassination of Lord French. So how did that affect the situation?
Well, obviously you had an escalation of IRA activity from early 1920, and especially in April, where they burned over 100 RIC barracks, and obviously in May 1918 you had the attempt on John French, and that kind of brought about obviously the change of tact, and where the original legislation would have allowed for the arrest and internment of men in England, the restoration of order in Ireland regulations actually allowed for them to regulate for internment on the island of Ireland. And when so, the amendment...
So Liam, just to clarify, so this is a brand new piece of legislation brought in specifically for the Irish situation.
Yeah, because under French, like he was basically in charge of a quasi-military government, and they could pass legislation under the regulations that wouldn't necessarily have to go through Westminster. And that came about, I think, in August 1920, where they actually, the restoration of order in Ireland came into effect. And then the decision then to focus on mass internment was made, obviously, after the Bloody Sunday situation on the, I think it was the 22nd of November. And that brought about basically the legality or to legalise internment on the island of Ireland. And obviously, say November, December, there were just mass arrests and men were being held in various locations all over the country.
Liam, can I just hold you there for 1 second? Because I want to just deal with something, because we're going to get into the thing of internment camps and the 1921 period. I just hold that thought for a moment, because I want to go back to Mary McAuliffe on a question which may get lost, you know, if we move forward to the discussion. That is, how did the IRA treat its prisoners? Because obviously, as the conflict escalated, more and more they are taking prisoners and taking hostages. So what was the policy of the IRA and the Republican movement generally?
I think from the evidence we get an idea that there was variations in how the prisoners were treated, that is, prisoners taken by the IRA, usually members of the Crown Forces, and how they were treated. Sometimes very well, sometimes badly. Obviously, quite a number were executed in response to execution of IRA prisoners. The most famous story of that era that influenced, I suppose, a short story writer is Frank O'Connor's Guests of the Nation. Guests of the Nation, where he writes about the two British prisoners being kept by the IRA and how they have discussions, they form relationships. In terms of having political discussions with their warders, I suppose you'd call them, and with the old woman who's feeding them. But inevitably, they have to be executed because of the execution of some IRA prisoners. And this is this reflects, in fact, what was reality. Major Geoffrey Lee Compton Smith, who seems to have developed a really close relationship with his captors when he was being held in April 1921 in the Boggara Mountains, and inevitably was executed on April the 30th because of the execution of IRA prisoners. He wrote lots of letters, which we have access to, which survived, that indicated that he had a certain sympathy with the Republican cause and saw his captors as, men who were ideologically committed. These weren't thugs or terrorists in his eyes. And he wrote letters to his wife, et cetera, et cetera. But he was then executed.
Mary, can I just stop you there just to remind our listeners that there's if they go on the RTE player, right, there was a brilliant documentary, the documentary on one, I Am to Be Shot. Now, it was presented by Saoirse Ní Chiachán. Now, obviously, a very talented young woman, because 3 years ago, she won the school's essay competition on this whole Lee Compton Smith story, so you can read that in the September October 2018 issue of History Ireland, and the documentary in one, which is really excellent. I think that the twist in this case is that the reason the IRA got him was he was playing offside with some nurse or something and locally. There's a lovely twist to this story.
It's not an unusual twist, because if you look at how women were under surveillance by the IRA in the revolutionary period for company keeping, quite a number of members of the Crown Forces, Black and Tans or RIC, were actually attacked, some wounded, many killed, because they were known to be dating, company keeping, meeting somebody. And the girls were watched, or the women were watched. And then when the meeting took place, they were either kidnapped or ambushed and shot. But there are two instances in North Kerry that kind of give a reflection of the different ways the prisoners of the IRA were treated. In November 19... 20 two RIC men were captured by the Ballylongford Company of the IRA, And they were brought and kept under guard, including by some Cumannamon women. So the women were, in fact, part of keeping prisoners as well, and usually were the ones feeding them. The British Army issued an ultimatum that the town would be razed to the ground if the men were not released, and they were released. But there is obvious evidence that they were heavily mistreated while they were in prison. They were beaten up. And one of them, Constable Muir, actually committed suicide a few weeks after his release. On the other hand, then, a fisheries officer, James Kane, who was kidnapped by the IRA in June 1921 by the Listowel IRA, kept for a few days at the house of Patrick Bruder. We know that from the Bureau of Military History statements. And then was executed, was allowed to write a letter to his family. And it's a very poignant letter. You know, he says, "My dear children, I'm condemned to die. I had a priest today, thank God." So the IRA brought a priest to hear his last confession. Because, of course, James Kane was an Irishman who happened to be a servant of the Crown in his role as a fisheries officer, and had some association with the RIC. So he was considered a candidate for execution. And there's a whole, you know, telling them what to do and where his money is, and he's leaving money in his pocket. And that is all delivered to his family. And he says, "I got the greatest kindness from the men who were in charge of me during his kidnap." So here he is, you know, saying they were kind to him. He asked them to leave his body where it would be found quickly so he can be buried, as he says, "Bury me near my loving wife, if possible, and give my gold watch to Eddie, and the watch and the desk to Frank, his two sons." So there you have two different instances of how the IRA was treated. So I can't say there's one way the IRA were treating prisoners. Sometimes they were awful to them. Sometimes there was a great sympathy between the prisoner and the prison keepers. And of course, that again brings in the whole, you know, complicated, nuanced interactions between those who were in the Crown forces or who were servants of the Crown in their jobs as RIC men or fisheries officer or Coast Guard keepers, et cetera, et cetera, and the IRA men, who all knew each other in many ways. So I think Frank O'Connor's Guests of the Nation does really capture that complexity of the relationships and the huge tragedy of the executions on both sides.
Now, May, just before we finish this point, apart from hostages, right, did the IRA hold any kind of ordinary, decent criminals, if I might call them that, in their role as, you know, the Republican police, for example?
Oh, they did. They did. I'm actually just finished doing a little bit of a piece of research on a woman they held in Clare, Bridie Burke, who was a typist in Victoria Barracks in Cork. And she was suspected of passing information to the Crown forces there, and particularly being a friend of a Constable Kelly, who was regarded as a particularly nasty piece of work in terms of intelligence gathering on the IRA, and was suspected of being one of the torturers of one of the Hales brothers who had been arrested in that time. And she was held by the IRA in Clare, held for a number of weeks. And the last communique we have from the West Clare IRA about Bridie Burke to GHQ in Dublin was that she was being released because the truce had come into being, and she may thank God that she was not a man, otherwise she would have been shot for her activities. And basically she's released on a promise, which she signs, that she would give up her job in Victoria Barracks. So not only are they holding people that are suspected of spying, they're also holding women. It's not just men. They are taking prisoners, taking women prisoners as well, and holding them. And making
Mary, where did they hold them?
They hold them in private houses. Bridie Burke was held in a safe house in Clare. We don't get the addresses of it, but they're being held in safe houses. They also have, you know, prisons in isolated areas of the countryside, maybe old sheds that have been made secure, caves, places like that. So they have a number of different types of places that are reconditioned, I suppose, to become IRA prisons.
Maybe I don't, this is an apocryphal story I half remember, but I half remember a case where a kind of ordinary decent criminal, if I might call him, was being held on some island somewhere in the middle of some river. and the British authorities came to rescue him, and he refused to be rescued, saying he was a prisoner of the Irish Republic and proud of it. Right now, whether that's true or not, it's a good story. One thing you touched on, Mary, and if the others want to come in on this, is what extent was there, you know, torture might be too strong a word, but mistreatment, torture, because I'm thinking of listeners who watched, you know, The Wind That Shakes the Barley, that fingernail pulling sequence. It ranks up there with the Nazi dentist in Marathon Man. Great torture scenes in cinemas. My students love it when I show it to them. Is there much evidence for that on either side?
Oh, yes, there is evidence for, I don't think fingernail pulling, but there is evidence for physical assault and beating up of prisoners, certainly by the IRA. And also, obviously, in the Bridie Burke story, the Captain Kelly, who is the intelligence officer operating out of Victoria Barracks in Cork, is thought to be the torturer of Sean Hales, who was very, very badly damaged by his experience in prison. So we do have evidence on both sides that there was, there might have been good relationships like Compton Smith and maybe James Cain, even though they both ended up being executed. But there was also evidence that there was mistreatment and there on both sides, there was torture. There was, beating the seven or beating them up pretty badly. And of course, then quite a number were executed. And their bodies disappeared, particularly by the IRA.
William, you want to come in on that?
Yes, just on, you know, the dangers to prisoners. I mean, I think it's very clear in 1920 and 1921 when IRA suspects are arrested that the most dangerous phase for them is in the period immediately after arrest and before transfer into what one might describe as an official system, whether it be the internment camps or to prisons themselves. So it's the periods where they're being held in local jails, local courthouses, local barracks, or indeed when they're being sometimes brought out and taken on control and effectively being used as hostages by either the auxiliaries, black and tans, or the local British Army. And that's the phase when they're most vulnerable to being physically abused, to being shot out of hand. For instance, an example in Wexford in Enniscorthy Courthouse is it's pretty clear, for instance, that some prisoners are, you described as torture, are being held in the courtyard and they're having freezing water directed upon them using hoses and for periods and things like that. But this is less common once the prisoners are moved into an official system, which is more regulated and where there are clear-cut terms upon which, you know, the imprisonment is supposed to take place. Now, that's not to say that ill-treatment of prisoners doesn't take place in those spaces also. And for instance, even inside the internment camps, there are notorious cases of prisoners being shot dead. So there's a man called Patrick White down at Spike Island who's shot when he's trying to reach for a ball through the barbed wire. Tighe Barry, very famously, is shot in Ballykinlar when he's, you know, simply among a group of prisoners who's celebrating other prisoners' release. So there continue to be dangers once one reaches the prison or the camp, but certainly the dangers are much greater before one reaches the prison or the camp.
Well, let's bring Liam back in there, like, because he was about to get on to talk to us about the introduction of mass internment, Liam. And, you know, what was the infrastructure then for this? Is one thing introducing internment, but you have to put them somewhere. So what was the system then that came into being towards the end of 1920?
Well, following the arrest, as I said, they were housed pretty much in any large building in various towns throughout the country. And it was in December 1920 where they decided that they would have to put them in a camp. And Ballykinlar was selected because it was a pre-existing camp and used for the British the British military and for the training of members of British military from the six counties, and was purpose-built. It had the huts and it was enclosed, and they found that it to be the most kind of appropriate location. And there was 300 in the first draft being brought in, and then as they were there, more and more men were being transferred, primarily by boat from various parts of the country, and then by train from Belfast. And the number one compound filled up fairly quickly, and then they were actually in the process of preparing the number two compound, and that continued. And like Ballykinner was obviously unique in that it was the first internment camp ever to be established on the island of Ireland and was the largest. And it, as I said, it very quickly filled. And then you had various other internment camps then being identified, and obviously the Rath camp and the Spike Island, and it was Berra. But I think obviously whenever the trigger or the reason for introducing mass internment was brought about on 22nd November 1920, following Bloody Sunday. But before that, and it gave the British a great starting point for the in relation to the arrest of individuals, when they discovered a briefcase that was left by Rachel Mackay in the house of Dr. Michael Hayes, who lived in South Circular Road in Dublin. And in that, they discovered there was 200 names and addresses of IRA members throughout the country. So it gave them a great starting point in terms of identifying who should be interned. But obviously, it was a majority, well, not a majority, but certainly a lot of men who were arrested and interned had no association with the IRA or Sinn Féin. And there were obviously mechanisms within the regulations for them then to seek their release. But many who probably hadn't had any association were, and due up to the treatment they received following arrest, they were happy to remain in Ballykinner and probably later on became associated or membership of the IRA.
Now, Liam, what was life like in these camps? I mean, are we talking about kind of like in the movies, kind of POW camps, people wearing their own clothes? What was the regime?
Yeah, I mean, that's how it was. But I mean, Ballykinner was where it was basically located, and Dundrum Bay, it was open to the elements. And when they arrived, the first group arrived, they walked into huts that were probably with puddles on the floor and were damp and weren't really habitable. And they had to take straw from a local store to try and make mattresses and pillows and various things like that. And the camp itself was always waterlogged, and it wasn't a very nice place to be. And then when the drier weather, then they were actually had to contend with the sand blowing, and that caused various ailments for various men, from breathing issues to eyesight. And it certainly wasn't anything like you would see in any of the movies. It wasn't as clean and tidy as you would see it.
But did it build morale amongst the prisoners? Well, this is the thing. I mean, I think that many listeners would have the view that, you know, that your Fron got the University of Revolution. I mean, were they all mini universities of revolution, or is that people retrospectively putting a positive glow on their prison time?
It was. I mean, what you had in Ballykinner was you had there were 65 men who had been interned in 1916. And they had obviously had the experience of how to counter the reason for internment. And they basically set about designing education programs, and was Dr. Michael Hayes and Henry Dixon. And they introduced various classes, and from Irish language, bookkeeping, shorthand, French, the classics. There were the classes in surveying and mathematics. And there was obviously other classes for people who didn't want to go into the education system, and simple things like chess and drama was a big thing. So the whole idea was to ensure that every man was active throughout their stay while in Ballykinner, because they felt that they could see certain individuals who had no interest in anything were suffered more, because they basically had nothing to do all day. And then where mental health issues actually arising as well, because they felt that they should never have been there. And they're always encouraged to get involved in sport as well. The GAA, they had football leagues as well. So the whole idea was to basically keep everyone active and keep them occupied throughout their stay there. And men who probably wouldn't have received the education on the outside were coming out of Ballykindler with qualifications that were actually accepted whenever they went and seeking employment on their release. So there were certificates issued, so it was a positive thing.
So it was actually a university. William, wanted to come in on that?
Yeah, just to emphasize what Liam was saying, I mean, one of the things that's very important for the prisoners when they're organizing those kind of classes, indeed the sports, is they're demonstrating to the people who are holding them their own capacity for self-governance, and the fact that they are, you know, they have the ability to create their own regime and impose that regime upon the prisoners themselves, so to speak. You know, with sport, they're doing things like, you know, they're controlling the space by marking out the football pitches or the race tracks when they organize races on racing day. They're they're imposing a timetable on their on themselves and their colleagues through, so, you know, classes are this time of the day, sports are this time of the day, etc. They're even imposing sort of levies and taxes on the prison population to purchase the educational equipment or the sporting equipment. So all this kind of activity is building a sense of cohort identity, and it's also demonstrating their capacity for self-governance in some ways, right under the eyes of the empire, under the eyes of the soldiers who are holding them.
James, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, just on that, much the same thing was happening in the RAT internment camp with classes and that going on. And again, it was trying to keep morale up because a lot of the prisoners would be quite elderly as well. Some of them were in their 60s that were arrested. And the British always tried to put a label on their prisoners. And the thing with British military intelligence was that it wasn't really that intelligent, that everybody they arrested, it, they deemed to be an officer or a commandant or a major or a general or something like that. They like to put all these terms on them, that they were all officers and men of the volunteer movement. But where Michael O'Leary says only about 50% of the men in the RAT internment camp were actually Republicans. The rest were just, they could be labor unionists or trade unionists, or they could be just people that were related to volunteers and that. Like Donald O'Buchla, his brother was 65 or something, and the British had him down as an officer in the IRA, and he wasn't even in the IRA at all. It was just that he was deemed because of association. Two students came down to Kevin Barry's house to help with the harvest in Carlow, and they were arrested along with Kevin Barry's brother just because he was Kevin Barry's brother, and neither of them, or none of them, had any part or parcel of the Republican movement at the time. But just thinking about health-wise and things like that in the internment camp, in the period from the 1st of March when the RAT internment camp opens until it closes in 6th or 7th of December, not one prisoner died, even though conditions were pretty harsh and there was a lot of prisoners suffering with tuberculosis and consumption. And if they got really bad, the British would release them. But in that same period, 12 British soldiers died in the Curra military camp from the same type of thing, from consumption, tuberculosis, shooting one another, or accidental shootings as well.
So you're safer in the internment camp, you're saying?
Seemingly, yes.
Liam, did you want to come in there?
Yeah, just a comparison with Ballykindler when there were, like it was mentioned earlier by William, Tag Barry was shot pretty much weeks before they're actually released. And then before that, in January of 1921, you had the Joseph Tormey and Patrick Sloan from Westmeath who were both shot with a single bullet. There was a number of men then that died of, I think there's five men died then from various diseases, pneumonia, Bryce disease and ill treatment and tuberculosis. There was very rarely you would have had men released due to ill health, and it was more so to do with kind of mental health, breakdowns in mental health. But Ballykindler was a more harsh regime, I think.
James, can I just come back to you on the question of escapes? Now, we're going to talk about the RAT escape in a minute, but apart from the RAT escape, what were the other great escapes of this period? And by the way, can I just preface that with a question? In terms of, you know, the Geneva Convention, is it the duty of every POW to try to escape?
No, they were under no obligation to escape, and many prisoners were content, as you say, to remain in the internment camp because it was actually safer inside than it was outside, because you have a bigger risk of being killed if you're an active volunteer. But there was a lot of prisoners just decided that they wanted out as soon as they arrived. And Rory O'Connor was one of the first. Like, the, as I say, the internment camp opens on the 1st of March. 6 days later, Rory O'Connor and Daniel Ryan escaped from the Rat internment camp by just practically walking out the front gate. Daniel Ryan was a Tipperary man who was active with Dublin Brigade. And the first day he arrives in the Rat internment camp, he meets a fellow called Jerry Gaffney, who happens to be a member of his company and was working as a carpenter on the construction of the internment camp. And he has a chat with him, and they arrange then for workmen, two of the workmen, to stay away from work on the day and to smuggle in some dungarees and other work clothes for both Rory O'Connor and Daniel Ryan. And on the Sunday then, the workers don't turn up, and the boys go out the front gate as if with the work party right past the British sentries. They're in Dublin by 3 o'clock that day. After getting the train, they go over to Kildare, they get a return ticket to Kildare from Dublin.
Return ticket?
Yeah, just in case anybody, it arouses suspicion that they're going on one way.
Oh, right.
So okay. It's well planned and all that. And Pater McMahon is actually the OC of the internment camp, and Joe Lawless is his vice OC. Rory O'Connor thought that he should be the OC of the camp. So both Lawless and Pater McMahon, when they heard that he was going to escape, they said, yeah, this is great, because we at least we get rid of Rory and his opinions. And he gets back to Dublin by 3 o'clock, where he meets Michael Collins, who congratulates him, of course, on escape. And so the Rat internment camp is deemed inescapable. Within a week, two prisoners are gone out the front gate.
Now, William, just to bring you in there, presumably that there's huge propaganda potential in such escapes.
Absolutely. They're widely publicised by the Irish nationalist press, but also by the international press. They're one of the ways in which the Irish cause, receives attention. They're a huge morale boost for the prisoners themselves, obviously those who are left behind, but also they're a morale boost more generally to the organisations, the revolutionary organisations. I think one of the things that's very interesting about escapes is the sense that, you know, the prisoners resist in various ways, whether it be through, very famously, we've talked about hunger strikes, but they resist through, work strikes, or they keep prisons awake at night by constantly banging on their doors, they riot, etc. But actually, escape is a very effective form of resistance. And Kieran McAvoy, who has written about political prisoners in the context of Northern Ireland, describes them as resistance as ridicule. That you, again, I sort of alluded to this earlier, that you are making the authorities look utterly ridiculous. You are making them a laughing stock. And as a consequence of making the authorities a laughing stock, you demean them. You question their ability to govern. But also, you raise morale on your side. So, and come the truce period that we're talking about here, I mean, many of the camps and prisons have become quite civ-like, quite frankly, because if you look at the prisons, many of the warders who are holding these prisoners in Irish prisons are more and more aware that this is a regime that's coming to an end. Some form of settlement is going to be arrived at. And here they are holding. They are the last line of defence, holding the people who are, the members of the new incoming regime in a position of having to hold them right through to the end. And many of those warders begin to, some had always cooperated with the prisoners and, allowed in contraband and things like that. But there's an increased level of contraband smuggling into the prisons. There's an increased level of turning a blind eye to prisoners digging tunnels or attempting to escape out of prisons. As it happens across the camps. It happens in the prisons. For instance, in Kilkenny Prison in November 1920, 44 men dig a tunnel and get out through the tunnel. In Mountjoy in late 1921, there are four women who escape out of their wing and out over the wall. They stage their colleagues stage a football match to distract the authorities while these four women are getting out. So imprisonment becomes very common at a point where it's increasingly clear that the authorities are struggling to maintain their hold on the country.
Well, listen, James, let's go back to you now for the main event here, the Riot Camp Escape, because this happened in September 1921. Now, this is, what, 2-3 months after the truce. So just going back to William's point, it's clear to everyone, that which way things are flowing, you know, that there's going to be a settlement. So just give us a rundown. What happened in the Riot Camp?
Well, see, most prisoners expected to be released as soon as the truce was signed. And Todd Andrews talks about his mother contacting him and saying that she was going to send a taxi up to bring him home after the truce was signed. But, of course, this never happened. And the longer the negotiations go on, the prisoners get a bit more disillusioned and they decide that they're going to escape anyway. And I think that both sides were using the truce as a breathing space. Like, both sides thought that there would be a return to war. And of all the prisoners that escape, everybody returns to active service as soon as they get out and return to duty, including all the prisoners that escape from the Rat internment camp. And I was able to name 54 of them who did escape, because they never really kept a list of who escaped in any way, because, of course, Republican propaganda put the number of escapees at 100, and, of course, it wasn't. It was in around 50 or 60. But what happened was that there was two tunnels going at the same time. Now, an earlier tunnel had been discovered in May, and this was because someone had sent a letter out to GHQ, which had been picked up by the British, and it was all the arrangements for escape. So they knew there was a tunnel in there. So they sent troops in to find the tunnels. Now, earlier, like, the first regiment that were guarding the men were the Suffolk Regiment. Todd Andrews says that they were generally quite good to the prisoners. They weren't that bad to them. But they were replaced then by the King's Own Scottish Borderers of Bachelor's Walk infamy. And they were a lot more tougher on the prisoners than the Suffolks had been. And these are the ones that discovered the tunnel, and that, of course, privileges are withdrawn as soon as they find anything like this. But there's two tunnels started then and is shortly afterwards, because the prisoners realised that they're not going to be released en masse, and they decided to escape. One of them is the Dublin Brigade Tunnel, and the majority of prisoners from whatever county, they're all from the Midlands area, were from Dublin. And then there was a lot of prisoners from the West and from the Midlands. So there was two tunnels, the Dublin Brigade Tunnel and what was known as Brady's Tunnel, or the Tullamore Tunnel, was started by men from the West, because we're all in huts together. Like, the idea then that you would stop spies infiltrating the internment camp was to put, say, all the Killarney men together, all the Dublin men together, all the Galway men together. And that way then your officer would know whether you were trustworthy, whether you were volunteering or not. So the Dublin Brigade Tunnel was quite ambitious, and it had wooden hoardings along the sides and over the top and that. And they were going to try and get out as many men as possible in it. Where the Tullamore Tunnel, or Brady's Tunnel, was started by Jim Brady, who was a miner from Cavan, and who had worked in the Rignan mines. He dug his tunnel like a rabbit burrow, just a round tunnel that you could actually just crawl out through, rather than the Dublin Tunnel, which would have been a bit more sophisticated. But the problem was that the British had decided to build an extension to the Rat internment camp, because there was still many more prisoners coming in, and they were housed in tents, so they had to build an extension to it. The escape would have come up right in the centre of this new compound, and that pushed forward the escape plans, and they were set then for September the 9th. The Dublin Brigade Tunnel would not be finished in time. So what they did was they joined forces with the Tullamore Tunnel, or Brady's Tunnel, and they picked 25 men from each, from Dublin Brigade and from the West, that were going out through this tunnel. And GHQ had sent word in that they wanted certain men to escape, like Joe Vyse and the Boer Burren from Dublin as well. So they wanted select men to escape. So the escape went ahead then on September the 9th. But like the Great Escape in the movie, you know, the Stephen Queen movie, the boys come up in the middle of the new internment camp, which was to be opened in a couple of days.
From one jail into another jail.
Yes. And they had stolen a wire cutter from Royal Engineers who'd been working on the barbed wire entanglements and that. So they had a way of getting out through. And they ran a length of twine, just like in the movie, they ran a length of twine to the far barbed wire entanglements, cut that, and then escaped out through it. So anybody coming up then would follow the trail of twine over to the wire and out through the wire. And in total, 54 men escaped in total, at least. And all of them returned back to active duty. All of them returned back to the IRA because they were expecting to go back to war.
Tell me this, James, were such escapes a breach of the truce?
Well, the thing is that Jim Steyn's escapes from Hare Park Camp now, which is adjacent to the Rat internment camp, and this had been a holding place since 1916, since the Rising, and on and off. And it continues up to 1924, and the Free State authorities continue using it as an internment camp. But he escapes from there. A truck had reversed in by mistake, and both him and another prisoner jumped on the back of the truck. The other prisoner was captured, but he escaped. So the British then, that they decided then to stop parole of prisoners, because prisoners were intermittently released on parole for maybe 2 weeks, and then they would return to camp. And they seen it as a breach of the truce agreement, where Michael Staines had been appointed as a liaison officer for internment camps and prisoners, and he said it wasn't. But the British demanded that Jim Staines return to prison, and of course he didn't.
Tell us, Liam, just while all this is happening, from the truce, the treaty negotiations, and all these guys are still sitting in these camps, what was their attitude to the treaty negotiations? I mean, I'm thinking, like, was there resentment that some people were being released and other people weren't?
Well, there was a number of people released unconditionally following the truce, and it wasn't a large number of men, but some would say that those released were kind of men of influence, and while others were just happy to kind of wait there until the outcome of the negotiations. And I think, I remember reading the account of Michael Sheehy from Offaly, and he's actually sitting in the tunnel the day after the treaty was signed, and he's basically given a copy of the Irish Independent, and he sat and read it, and he thought, right, that's no need for this tunnel anymore. But I don't know. I mean, there's no reason given for why certain men are released, but there are, from July onwards, there are regular releases, and men are basically just being called out and told they're free to go. I think Louis Walsh was one. He was a solicitor from County Antrim, based in Mahara and Derry, and he was just called up unannounced. He had made no request to be released, while others had been probably put in requests, or requests had been made from the outside that they should be released.
I mean, how did prisoners generally break on the treaty? I mean, were they just the same as everywhere else, or did they tend to go one way or the other?
Well, there's no indication that what their feelings were. I suppose a lot, given that the treaty was signed, were pretty convinced they were going to be released, and were more kind of focused on that.
Tell me this, when were the last prisoners released then? I mean, the treaty is signed on December the 6th, 1921. When were the prisoners released, the internees?
They started, I think it was from the 8th of December onwards. They were basically organising the release of all prisoners.
James, you want to come in on that?
I found that there was a bit of resentment in the internment camps about prisoner, you know, profile, as Liam was saying, or William was saying, more profile prisoners being released. There was 25 TDs in the Rat internment camp at the time, and they were all released to take part in treaty negotiations at home and that. And Desmond Fitzgerald was also there as well, and he was released. He was actually escorted to Dublin by Lieutenant Vinden, the adjutant of the internment camp. Vinden and a fellow officer had loaded revolvers in their pockets when they brought Desmond Fitzgerald to Merrion Square, where again he meets Michael Collins and several other prominent leaders. And Vinden records that they were well treated by Collins and those top Sinn Féiners that they met. But a lot of the junior prisoners then kind of resented that the top men were getting out, and there was even talk that the top men were getting jobs for themselves or making jobs for themselves on the release, and that there was a lot of heated debate within the Drat internment camp on the progress of negotiations and that. And it was of two strains. One was for the treaty and one was against it. And others were saying that they shouldn't be signing anything unless the treaty is put forward to the people. And that. And one of those prominent in that is Tom Bean, who was an intelligence officer from Ratangan in County Kildare. And he's against the treaty. He says, if this treaty goes ahead, he says, we are looking at civil war. And of course, he's proved right. And he's actually killed in the internment camp, or going to the internment camp under controversial circumstances in December 1922 by the National Army.
William, did you want to come in on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to stress again that I think this sense of quite a large number of the prisoners were resentful of their ongoing internment in the phase, after the signing of the truce and before the signing of the treaty. And both Liam and James, I think, have referred to the liaison officers and Michael Staines in particular. And, when Staines and the other liaison officers were appointed in the aftermath of the truce, their primary task was to try and maintain the truce and cooperate with the British authorities in the maintenance of that truce. But they also had an oversight role in terms of the camps and prisons. So they were coming in and visiting. And I suppose at one level, what they were attempting to do was ensure that the conditions were improving inside the camps, or that the conditions were at least up to some sort of standard. But over and over again, what they found themselves doing is coming into the camps and delivering a message to the disgruntled prisoners that they just had to wait, and that they shouldn't engage in, for instance, protests or riots inside the prisons or the camps. And they were largely successful in that in many places. But for instance, in Spike Island in Cork, that message either didn't get through or wasn't delivered as strongly as it was in some of the other places. And in part, I think that was because Tom Barry was the relevant liaison officer. And Barry was not at all happy at his task of attempting to manage revolutionary activity, at attempting to keep people quiet and patient and waitful while the negotiations went on. And therefore, as a consequence, you get very, very serious rioting at Spike, and the camp effectively gets burned down during the truce period. Whereas in some places like Ballykinlar, where the leadership inside the camp are much more effective at managing morale and at communicating the message that we have to wait, and that we, the agreement is coming, hold the line, lads, you have less trouble.
Now, looking at the time here, we're going to wrap up here, but Mary, I just wanted to go to you for one point. We're not going to talk about the Civil War, because that's going to be another head school. But one question I want to ask you is, I know women spent relatively less time, interned compared to men. That didn't make it any less traumatic, of course. But that wasn't the case in the Civil War. Just give us a quick, teaser for what we might, a discussion we might have the next head school on this topic, Mary.
Yes, obviously, fewer women were arrested during War of Independence. Fewer women were held for longer. You do have a lot of arrests of women, but they might only be held for 24 hours in a local jail, searched by a woman searcher and then released and told to go home and behave themselves. Only a few were held for long periods of time, like Ethna Coyle and Linda Kearns, who would have been regarded as quite subversive and needed to be imprisoned. But in the Civil War, that does change. And so generally, if you had maybe less than 100 women, 60 or 70 women arrested in the War of Independence, you have upwards of 600 arrested and imprisoned during the Civil War. And I think the main reason for that is that they are former comrades, because obviously all of the women arrested were anti-treaty. Their former comrades who were pro-treaty, and particularly in the National Army, knew what they could do and knew their importance to helping continue both the propaganda, but also the military side of the irregular campaign. They were the intelligence officers, they were the running the safe house. They did very much what they did during the War of Independence for the IRA. And so the importance of that to the conduct of a guerrilla campaign was very much something that the National Army and the civil authorities wanted to shut down. And also the women were driving a lot of the propaganda, the anti-treaty propaganda. And so they were arrested for that as well. So, you know, you have women from Donegal down to Kerry, from Tipperary, all being arrested, swept up in mass arrests, and then being taken up to Kilmainham or Mountjoy. And then when the North Dublin Union opens up, they're being held there. So they're the three main centres. For example, I was looking at a letter of Mrs. Coyle, Etna Coyle's mother, was writing to Min Mulcahy, who was Mrs. Mulcahy. Obviously, Richard Mulcahy was a senior figure in the first Irish Free State government, that her daughter was on hunger strike in Donegal in Ballyshannon because she was being held there without any female warders. And she was on hunger strike to be removed to Kilmainham Jail, where she could be among women and where she would be, you know, looked after by women warders. So there's all those aspects of it that we have to consider, not just that the women were imprisoned, but also how they were guarded and how they were treated in prison, as well as obviously all the men that were arrested in this period. So that will be a big discussion that will be part of the Civil War commemorations coming up.
William, can I just pitch the same question to you about, you know, like, did these IRA prisoners, some of whom ended up on the pro-treaty side, did they learn any lessons from their own experience? Like, in other words, did they apply the same policies to anti-treaty people when it came to internment during the Civil War?
I suppose in general terms, I would say that one of the things that emerges is that the new elite of the Irish Free State, many of whom had been in prison themselves, many of whom who had deployed many of the sort of prison resistance strategies themselves in over the preceding 4 or 5 years, are a good deal more sceptical about prisoner resistance. They are less likely to concede in the face of it. They know themselves the sort of propaganda they deployed, the way they exploited prisoners. They are aware themselves of the level of exaggeration they used, even in their own campaigns. And so they, if anything, I think they are harsher on their prisoners than the British were, and there are more of them. So at the end of the Irish War of Independence, there were over 6,000 men and women in prisons and camps. At the end of the Civil War, there were closer to 12,000. Men and women in prisoners and camps. And I think the numbers also affect the conditions. So you have lots of prisoners in more crowded spaces, I think, and less well-controlled and managed spaces. So I think that's one of the factors we have to think about when we think about the Civil War prison experience as compared to the War of Independence prison.
Okay, so it's more Andersonville than Second World War POW movie type situation. From what you're saying. Listen, guys, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been marking the centenary of the Rath camp escape on the 9th of September 1921. And we've been listening to James Durney, Mary McAuliffe, William Murphy and Liam O'Dwyer. Our next Hedge School listeners will be on Crowdfunding the Revolution, the Underground Administration. And that will be posted at the end of this month. So I'd like to thank our panel here today. And I'd like to thank you, the listeners. And I hope you'll tune in for our next Hedge School. Thank you.